You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. Deep, we found out some information. I'm Rob Beiner-Cantor, senior editor. Deep Tran.
Associate editor?
Yeah, and
I'm Susie Evans. I'm the managing editor.
I just wanted to jump in, and we've found some stats about our podcast, right? People are actually listening to us, right?
Yes.
Not just Lucas Nath.
It's not just Lucas Nath as he's jogging on next to the river. Hi, Lucas.
So it's
500 downloads last month.
That's good, right?
I have no idea. No one ever talks about their podcast stats unless they're looking for advertisers.
Right. Well. We're not really looking for advertisers, but hey, we'll take your money.
Well, thank you all for listening to our lovely voices.
Yeah,
twice
indeed.
A month.
Indeed, we feels like we just did one. But we're still churning out those seasons, and the big news that I just literally put into a post is the Public Theater's new season. We talked on this podcast. I think we've had it long enough to have talked about how excited we were about the last season, not when they announced it, that would have been last spring, but when it was about to come. And we have done a lot of coverage of the public season, the Young Gene Lee's Straight White Men, a little show called Hamilton, Fortress of Solitude, a big, most anticipated musical.
Fun Home.
Fun Home was the previous season.
We still wrote about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
The
no,
quite a bit.
Sure. I mean, but I'm just talking season-wise, and then the season kicked off with what had only been done once before, right? But it was mm-hmm. It's become a new like routine thing, their public works thing. After they do their their season in the park of celebrity Shakespeare, two celebrity Shakespeare productions. Do we know what those are this year? They have announced them, or have they?
Oh, they
yes.
they announced it.
It's Jesse Tyler Ferguson and Hamish Linklater in
Tempest,
not Comedy of Errors.
That's our new editorial assistant, Allison Constantine, in the background. She doesn't have a headset, so she will just be...
So they're casting it with the clowns. I mean,
yes.
They're clown roles, but like, who's playing Miranda and
Well, Deep
Prospero?
Has the internet, so
okay,
she's finding
anyway.
Out.
So once they finish their... That was not my main point. Once they finish those Shakespeare ones, they still have the use of the Delacorte for a little longer. And for three or four performances, they do this giant free... adaptation of a classic. It's been Shakespeare before this year. It's going to be The Odyssey, and Lear de Besnay, the director, and the composer Todd Almond. They've done a version of this before. This is based on they did it at the Old Globe, and I think they even did they do it before that, or was that the Old Globe?
It was the Old Globe was the first one. We ran an article about that once when it first happened.
Yeah, Eliza
did
a piece.
Article.
It's kind of like a cornerstone type model where you work with non-professional community organizations. And cast them alongside professional actors and do a sort of free adaptation of a classic. I'm looking forward to that one a lot. That's in September. But you were going to tell me some information here?
Yeah, Cymbeline.
Cymbeline.
Daniel Sullivan is directing Cymbeline.
Who's playing Miranda
Cymbeline.
In The Tempest?
I don't. This is the NBC New York site. It doesn't tell me.
Well, that's
okay. I have to look at a different site.
The other thing about the coming season is. It's a return of a bunch of interesting folks who've had great success there before. Stu and Heidi Rodewald are bringing The Total Bent, which is a musical that was supposed to happen this past season but was canceled because Joanna Settle, their director, had breast cancer. She's fine now, and she's in Philadelphia, and they're going to bring The Total Bent, which sounds like an amazing sort of period musical set, I believe, in the South in the 60s, sort of gospel versus rock and roll type story. And also, Michael John Lacusa, whose First Lady Suite premiered at the Public in '93, is doing the First Daughter Suite. So it's like that one that was looking at various first ladies through history and doing a suite of songs about them. This one, and I think eventually they interacted with each other. This one is Patti Nixon and Amy Carter and so on. First Daughters, and the same director, Kirsten Sanderson, is going to direct it. Who did that? So that. That's a long callback. Michael John hasn't done a show there since Giant, I don't think. Deep, you'll be happy to know Barbecue.
Yes, I love me some Robert O'Hara.
I'm
going to do something about zombies. this month.
This one's not about... the Woolly Mammoth Show.
Yeah, the Woolly Mammoth Free the Beast Commission.
He's a very busy writer.
And director.
And then finally, Terrell Alvin McCraney, who's been there before, his show Head of Passes, which also seems gospel. It's like a gospel-themed show. I mean, it's based on the Book of Job. It has a lot to do with religion and faith from what I think it's...
Common topics that Terrell deals with.
Yeah, and it's coming up. It's playing right now at Berkeley Rep, and this is a co-production. Some great actors in that out there. Nicole Salter and a couple other folks. Michael Shepard, who I'm sure they'll come with it. So anyway, the public season, you know, and they, of course they do the mobile Shakespeare as well. So Lear is opening the season with a free thing in the park, and then closing with a mobile Shakespeare production of Romeo and Juliet, which tours the boroughs and then sits down at the public. In the midst of that, there's also an All's Well directed by Kwame Armah at the Mobile Shakespeare Unit. So it's really, you know, a lot of... And Kwame's directed there a couple times before. So, you know, this isn't quite the blockbuster season, I suppose, that the public just had with Hamilton. But it looks like another interesting, diverse...
Yeah, which show's going to transfer to Broadway this season, public theater?
I don't know.
Whichever one gets the enhancement Hamilton. Money, right?
I somewhat doubt First Daughter Suite is a Broadway type show, but that's, you know, the Total Bet.
Total Bet, maybe. Total Bet. I mean, Passing Strange made it to Broadway.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I actually noticed last week when we wrote the Magic Theater that a good amount of seasons of theaters are doing all female seasons.
I noticed that Rep Stage in Maryland announced one.
Yeah, and the Yale Rep.
Was that all female or is it female heavy? I don't remember Yale Rep.
Wait, Yale Rep or Rep Stage?
All the new plays at Yale Rep were written by women. I think they might have had some.
Well, I have the internet, so I remember as we're talking.
I just go by my memory of headlines. It was a male or female dominated season. Whereas Rep Stage in Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, and the Magic Theater both specifically announced all female seasons. And we should clarify, all female written seasons.
Yes. Did they put that in their press release as like publicizing, or is it just they happen to be all female?
You know, I think they do headline it. And Magic Theater definitely did. And I believe Rep Stage did. And I don't know. I don't think anyone's hiding it.
Yale Rep didn't headline it, though. It was just happened to exist.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a five-play season. It's two classics. You know, one Shakespeare, one Beckett, and three new ladies.
Three new ladies.
Well, all the new works are
that's
women.
All good. All new works, yeah. Which is kind of where the trend is if you look at new plays or young writers versus older ones. The tide seems to be turning a bit in the right direction.
Or Wendy Wasserstein doesn't get revived as much as she should.
Yes.
well, she's been on Broadway multiple times.
Well, I noticed that Emily Mann's
Twice.
Having Her Say is
Same
coming
play.
Back. Mm-hmm. Emily Mann, that's a play from the 90s that's coming back. There was another one recently. Oh, Jessica Hagedorn's Dog Eaters, which is from the late 90s, is coming back to a theater. I mean, that's like almost a contemporary class. It's the kind of thing the Second Stage would revive, like a mid-90s
what
show.
What is it? I've never heard of it.
Jessica Hagedorn, who's a Filipino novelist, she wrote a novel called Dog Eaters.
Is it one word or two words?
They read it as one word, and a very provocative title for a play about Filipino, but that's what it's about. I mean, Filipinos, not dog eaters necessarily, but that's the sort of pejorative term that's used. Anyway, it was adapted into a play on the West Coast. I remember, now I don't remember which theater it is that's going to do it.
Magic Theater.
That's part of their all-female season includes a revival. So, yeah, that's not quite reaching as far back as Wendy Wasserstein. But, you know, it's interesting to me. It's not just brand new plays by women that are being
Wendy's not that old.
Revived. I mean, that's 80s versus, late 90s or whatever.
Yeah.
80s is 30 years ago. That's a freaky thing.
I mean, that's like, it's ancient. right. Wait, I was going to say something about this trend. Oh, one thing that I've noticed is that, you know, not that we are obsessively track the stats on our site, but... some of our biggest news items have been these and most shared items on social media are the ones about seasons with all female playwrights are heavily weighting that. I think I smell a possible angle for a story in the fall. Just so we know, just to note that in our heads.
Well, if you keep on wanting to read stories about women, we'll keep on writing stories about women.
All right.
Well, I lied about Wendy Wasserstein. She's had three plays on Broadway.
She's had three on Broadway?
Yeah, not including the recent revival of
You're
Hattie
saying
Krangles.
That's all she's ever had on Broadway?
Yep. American Daughter in 97, Sisters, Rosenzweig in 94, and Heidi Chronicles.
Yeah. And, you know, there are other great female writers, too, Carol Churchill, that are worth reviving. So revive them. Don't just get new ones. Revive them. I don't know if I have anything more to say about news. Anybody else have news items you wanted to mention? Do you want to talk about...
Susie went to the Lortel.
I went to the
Lortel Awards.
The Lucille Lortel Awards.
You're on the awards beat, Susie. Take it away.
I love the awards beat. The Lucille Lortel Awards, they're celebrating their 30th anniversary. I know we don't usually cover anniversaries, but that's the year we're in for the Lortels, and they honor the best in off-Broadway theater. They're named after Lucille Lortel, who I guess some journalists, I think Robert Coe in The Post or something, coined her the Queen of Off-Broadway, and now... She's called the Queen of Off-Broadway.
I looked that up. She's an actress, producer. She lived from 1900 to 1999. She literally lived for the entire 20th century, basically.
And she kind of has an Off-Broadway theater named after her.
She does.
Well, yeah.
It used to be called the Theater de Lise, but go on.
No, they showed little like rare clips of her at the awards ceremony. I was like, you should make a documentary about this woman. Apparently, she started out as an actress, and her husband didn't want her acting, and so she did it on the sly, and then she like became a producer later in life. And so it was at the Lortel's, which was basically the Hamilton show. Hamilton, also from the Public Theater, won 10 awards in every category it was nominated. It didn't win every award it was nominated for because there were two actors nominated in two categories. So Brian D'Arcy James and David Diggs were nominated for Best Featured Actor in a Musical, but David won. And Leslie Odom Jr. and Lin-Manuel Miranda were nominated for Leading Actor in a Musical, and Lin won. But every category it was nominated in, including sound design, lighting, costumes, everything, it won. So... got a little preview of what's going to happen at the Tony Awards next year, because it's opening at the Rogers in August. Yeah, so it was great. Another thing that I don't know if a lot of pieces noted in their coverage of the event, I don't even know if I noted it in mine, is that every actor who won an award at the ceremony was a person of color, which is wonderful. I mean, Jacob Ming Trent won for his great performance in Father Comes Home from the Wars, Parts 1, 2, and 3. He has kind of an epic monologue in the third part where he plays a dog and he thanked his dogs at home for their artistic inspiration in his speech. It was really
cute.
Well,
you did not put that in your piece.
I didn't remember his exact quote, so I didn't want to quote him and not get it wrong, but he thanked his dogs. Tanya Pinkins won her third Lortel for Rashida Spinking, which she did at the New Group. It was directed by Cynthia Nixon and also starred Diane Wiest. What's his name? I'm forgetting his name. Stephen McKinley Henderson won leading actor for Between Rivers and Crazy.
Nice.
Eliza Colon Zayas. Also won for featured actress for Between Rivers and Crazy, which got best play. Also won the Pulitzer this year by Stephen Adley Gurgis. Yeah, so it was a really good.
Did you mention Renee Elise Goldsberry?
Renee Elise Goldsberry won her first award ever for acting for Hamilton.
Blows me away. Considering how good she is.
So emotional. She was like, I've been performing for a really long time and I've never won an award before. She like couldn't handle it. Anyway, it was really fun. It's a fun event. They do it at the Skirball Center at NYU and lots of fun people come out. And
wait, they don't even do it at the Lortel? It's not big enough.
No. Jesse Tyler Ferguson hosted. He kind of seemed like he was trying to like show off his hosting skills. I think he might want to host on a bigger stage. He was like making lots of quips and lots of jokes. He'd like written all this material for himself.
Yeah, his Tony reel.
He's like trying to get his reel ready to host.
Neil Patrick Harris
can't
host everything.
He was really good. I'd give him my vote, but he had lots of funny little quips. He did like a little rap for Hamilton, and then when Lin did a rap for his acceptance for Best Musical for Hamilton, Jesse Tyler Ferguson came out and was like, I can't believe Lin did that. I just rapped. It was so funny.
Hopefully, Lin doesn't top himself for rapping, since he's going to have to do it next year, too.
I don't remember if he actually made this rhyme, but he did write out a little speech for Thank You for Best Musical that was like a little... It wasn't a freestyle because he wrote it, so I guess it was a rap. And he thanked Joe Papp. And I want to say he rhymed rap with Papp, but I might be wrong. He probably didn't. That probably seems too obvious. He's got really nuanced rhymes.
He does.
Anyway, it's a fun event, and it's a cool award show, and it, you know, a lot of the plays that won are things we've covered and, you know, talk about a lot on here, so yay New York award season.
Cool. So Deep, you're recently in Orange County, and not just to visit family. This time it was to see plays, too.
Well, that's the only reason I can negotiate going to Orange County on the AT budget, since...
Free housing.
And, you know, we're swimming in money in American theater, not really. So I'm from Orange County. My parents live there still, and they have a spare car they lend me whenever I'm...
Oh, a car, too. Wow. Transportation and housing.
Yes, exactly. So this person that we're setting up, that's our guest on this podcast, Queen Wynn, I gave him a ride after we finished our hour-long conversation about his new play that I saw at the reading at Pacific Playwrights. Viet Gone, and it's basically about how his parents left Vietnam in 1975 and how they met in a refugee camp in Arkansas. But the interesting thing that I'm noticing as I'm thinking more about this play, which is going to get production at South Coast Rep next year and
Oregon Shakes next year.
Oregon Shakes.
Yeah, yeah.
What I realize is interesting is it's kind of doing this thing that I've been noticing that other plays are doing now, which is code switching. I've noticed it in Hamilton, and I've noticed it in Octoroon by Brandon Jacob Jenkins.
Right.
And basically, what it is, it takes this historical topic and these characters, and it integrates like modern lingo and music stylings. And
right.
So I remember in Octoroon, the slaves, the women playing black slaves, talked like they were from the hood.
Right. Well, yeah, contemporary, very contemporary language.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, yeah. Yeah. Yes, you know, things like I know we're slaves and everything, but girl, you are not your job.
right, yeah.
And so I was thinking, is that a trend of some sort, or is this a really cool way of disarming an audience, because everyone thinks they know what the Civil War was like and what the Revolutionary War was like, or what the Vietnam War was like, because it's all in the history books. And so you think of these as old, dusty characters, and you make them fresh by putting in diverse faces and making them speak like they're living in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, the code switching typically has meant, from what I understand, it's a term employed by people of color to talk about the ways that they talk in different ways and behave in different ways depending on their setting, right? So Rayhan Salam wrote an essay for us about Hamilton, and he talked about, interestingly, about how comparing the code switching that people of color do and immigrants do in America to what the founding fathers did. He said all of them were British citizens paying taxes to Britain and felt themselves loyal British citizens, but then they also felt like, wait, we're also Americans. And he was saying that was interesting, the way that, of course, the cast of Hamilton and the language used in it made a contemporary sense out of this idea that you are code switching between one identity and another, right?
Mm-hmm.
Code switching is an interesting way to think about that. I think code switching also in terms of the theater audience, you know, a lot of these playwrights, we've talked about this before, with people like Taylor Mack and Young Jean, who come from a different theater making tradition, who are now working in the sort of establishment theaters, right? And using different forms and alluding to different forms when they get into those theaters. I mean, I think Hamilton, what people have noted is really interesting, is that it's a hip-hop theater. It comes from hip-hop theater tradition, but it's also really a Broadway show. So it's got both of those sort of forms and language traditions in it. It's interesting to explore those links, sort of anachronistic.
Like it's using an anachronism in order to disarm the audience and to make them relate to this material in a new way, so that these aren't foreign people. Because what I noticed in Viet Gone was the fact that, you know, you put an accent on stage and that character automatically becomes foreign
and alien
to you.
Right.
And so you take Vietnamese immigrants, you don't give them accents, you make them speak perfect English.
Right.
And
the
contemporary
English, too.
Contemporary English. Yeah. So there's like 120 fucks in that script. It was insane.
Podcast for mature audiences only.
Yeah, right.
Now, I told Quay he's allowed to say the F word just because it's not Queen Wing dialogue if there isn't copious amounts of that. But and then they had the Vietnamese immigrants talk in perfect English, but they had the American characters talk in just like a mishmash of different English words, like freckles, hamburgers, just like a mishmash of words that don't make sense individually.
So they didn't speak in complete senses.
Yes,
that's fascinating because. That's a reverse trope David Henry Wong did in Golden Child.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. it was set in China. I forget what era, sometime way back. And there was a white missionary who spoke in very broken English because he was an outsider. So David Heinemann had flipped that so that everyone in the play, since they're in their native environment, spoke perfect, you know, perfectly formed sentences, and then the outsider.
I feel like that was also accentuated by Matthew Mayer's performance.
In which?
Signature production of that?
I didn't see that one. That's written into the play.
It's
written in the play from whenever.
Matthew's one of my all-time favorite actors. I mean, he's
Matt Mayer.
Mayer. He's phenomenal, but he himself has a speech
impediment
He speaks openly about, a lisp. And so to have him speak that broken English as the outsider and have that on top of it was an interesting dramatic choice.
I didn't
know
that. Yeah, I know when it was written, it was just, they had just a typical, just, you know, old white guy play the part of the missionary. And again, it was striking because you realize, you know, this is how you don't speak the language well. This is how you sort of sound to the people that you're speaking to.
It was a nice
reversal. And it's interesting to know that Kui did a version of that. He did say David Henry Wong was an inspiration for the piece in some ways.
Jay-Z.
And Quentin Tarantino. That's a fun mix. So why don't we go to that exciting interview with Kui?
No. Oh my God. How do you ask those kind of questions? Like, tell me about how your mom met and, you know, what'd you do in the re-education camp? Like, how do you ask that kind of question?
Well, all I asked was like, hey, you know, like, I want to know. Well, I kind of lied to them because there was no way they were going to tell a story about Vietnam or themselves. Because I tried, like, when I was younger to tell, you know, get them to tell me stories. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you ask your parents stories and all they do is try to give you fables and, you know, with morals and stuff. It's like, oh, I learned this and this is how you're a good, you know, how to be a good man. And then when I got commissioned to do this project, I decided to lie to them and said, I'm going to write a general play about Vietnamese people, but I need material. So if you can tell me specific stories in your life, that will help me into writing the story that's not about you. And then they're like, oh, okay. And then they would start telling stories. And then basically at some point, you know, because I was always trying to maneuver it towards their love story, at some point they realized that when they talked about sex, it wigged me out just like as if I was like 13 again.
I mean, how do your parents talk to you about sex? Because it's not like,
well, it's just, you know,
it comes up
alcohol.
Oh, okay.
Alcohol helped, you know, and both basically at some point when they realized that it wigged me out, they just kind of were tickled by it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I am like, you know, in my later 30s, so they're kind of do see me as an adult because I have two kids myself, and so they feel a little more free to talk to me about just life stuff because they want me to be their friend now in this part of our lives, not just their kid. So they started telling me all these stories. And stories that they knew still wigged me out. And so that kind of became like the you know, heart and soul of what become Vid Gone, which they didn't know. At some point they realized, like, hold up, this isn't like a general story, is it? It's about us because you keep asking about us. I'm like, gotcha. And they were very much like, what are you going to put in there? I'm like, I'm going to put in the good stuff. And they have no idea. I think they haven't seen it. They haven't read it. You know, they'll see it this fall when it's getting produced because they were like, oh, we'll come and see it. I'm like, awesome.
Well, we just did the reading, so why didn't you invite them to
the reading? Well, I wanted them to see the production, you know, like I being not theater people, I'm always curious, like, if they would get what was happening, if there were people at music stands, because they get a show. But, you know, the whole, like, oh, we're going to read the script, and some of it's going to be slightly confusingly staged. I don't think that they would get it all the way, and I want them to experience it. Like, as a full production, you know, with like amongst an audience. So at least that when they're, you know, getting like their dirty laundry aired, they can go, well, at least it's funny and people are laughing at it. So maybe that's worth it. So we'll see. But you know, they've been very open. And my dad, if anything, has started writing short stories himself. They're all in Vietnamese. But, like, he's been starting to write because of this. Like, as I've been asking more stories from them, they've been telling me more stories. So now I feel like I have way more material than I could just put in Vid Gone. So I'm actually writing a 5-play, like, pentology at this point. And it all is, like, the kind of 5 different, like, movements in their marriage. Like, this was their wooing. Part 2 would be, like, them actually being married and assimilating the culture because they haven't yet. The third one is actually about my cousin's, you know, the immigrant story about bringing someone over. The fourth is my grandmother's suicide, actually, and her death. And it gives me opportunity to explore, like, her generation, which is even older than my parents' generation stories. And the fifth one is their retirement now, and now they're in their 70s, and kind of like just looking at how their love stories has kind of evolved and changed throughout that time. Because, you know, like, they, like, if anything, hearing their stories, they always kind of fell back to the fact that, like, they saved each other over and over again. Like, when my mom and dad didn't quite love America from being here because it was so hard, they were poor and we were living in, like, in, like, the poor part of town, they were very much like, love was what, you know, saved us. And then when my mom's brother died, you know, she's like, your dad saved me by, you know, reminding me that there was so much to live for. And then when her mother died, and now retirement. So it's all these different transitions and how they've had to find ways to fall back in love over and over again. And that's been kind of like the lesson I've learned from them. So
it's kind of like your Eugene O'Neill to our own family.
I guess so. I guess so. You know, hopefully I'll be successful. So,
yeah. Well, hopefully not as depressing.
Hopefully not as depressing. Well, I know the story so far, so they're not that depressing. I mean, as you just saw VidCon, it's like, I don't know how to do it depressing. I'm just a comedian by heart, and so,
yeah.
So I don't know how to write things that aren't, like, a little, you know, vulgar and funny. So. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know in your first play, I mean, not your first play, but the first time, like, you tackled this topic with Trial by Water, it was like a dramatic play. But then at the end of this one, your dad says you should stick with writing funny plays, and we don't need another war story.
Right.
What was the impetus for kind of taking the non-typical approach?
Well, it always kind of goes back to Trial by Water. Like, Trial by Water was, you know, it was the first play I ever wrote, period. It wasn't even just like my first, you know, production. Was my first play I ever wrote. And I, you know, at that point, you know, I was 22 when I wrote it, and I knew I wanted to tell my family stories. And so when we got produced and made, like, my mom and dad saw it, and it was the most, probably the most impactful note in my life was my mom going, "Oh, that was good. It doesn't sound like you." And of course I was offended. It's like, "What do you mean it doesn't sound like me? You don't know how I write. You've never read anything." And they were very much like,
"You see my plays?"
Yeah, you know, they're like, very much my mom's like, "I don't need to see your plays to know how you talk. And I know how you joke around." It's like, that's who I expect to see on that stage. And so from that point forward, I felt like she was very, very right. And so I've always kind of pursued my instincts now, which is always very comedic and very kind of irreverent, and finding ways to make it have impact, even though it seemingly seems like just straight up comedy. So trying to marry both those things together.
So. Yeah. Wait, so for anyone who doesn't know, Trial by Water was the dramatic play about your cousin.
Yeah, Voyage to America.
Yeah. On a boat.
Yeah, on a boat. As a boat person in 1988.
Oh my goodness. I think I was, I was talking to Aditi Kapil after this reading.
Oh, I love her. Yeah.
I know, I love her so much. And shout out. But I was telling her how this is the first time I've ever seen myself on stage, like, in a way that I didn't have to, like, actively pretend to be someone else in order to kind of find relation to it. I was like, "Oh, shoot, this sounds familiar. This sounds like a conversation that I've had with my dad."
Right. Yeah. Well, that was, like, I mean, like, you know, some people out there were like, "Oh, why did you choose to make them sound so youthful?" Because they, you know, like, the older board members here, who were very lovely and supportive, but they were just like, "Oh," that curiosity was like, "Why did you decide to make it, like, they talk like 2015, like, youth?"
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, "Well, I'm kind of writing it for the 16-year-old in me that was rejecting my culture. The kid that was like, 'No, I don't want to know about Vietnam. I don't want to feel like the outsider. I don't want to feel different.' And I was definitely rejecting my culture because I wanted to be American so badly. And so I was writing it for that kid, because I feel like there's a lot of us out there that, you know, like, the way that makes us feel like being part of the inside, we reject what makes us outsiders. And so I was like, "Well, then I'm going to speak their language. I'm going to write it in the language of, you know, how I spoke when I was 16. And so if there was a mission, it was to, you know, I, of course, want the world to see it and to be moved by my parents' story and to see a different, you know, angle of Vietnam War that they probably didn't think of before. But, you know, on a very just kind of base level, I would like to, you know, I would hope, like, you know, a whole bunch of like 16 to 25 year old Vietnamese kids show up watching and feel like it's a play for them and that they enjoy it because it's just a play that doesn't make them feel alienated. And they can, you know, in a very specific way, I want to write something that makes, you know, Asian men and women sexy. Like, it sounds so base, but I don't want Asian women to be sexy because they're a fetish. I wanted you know, that character to be sexy because she was just an attractive person. And same thing with, you know, Asian American men who are often not depicted in that way. So I wanted to just write a sexy play where people just felt, you know, like, I think it's really important to be able to see depictions of yourself, people that look like yourself on stage in a very positive way, in a strong way, in a sexually powerful way. And so I wrote a sex comedy about it.
which just so happens to be about your parents.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a weird thing to write a sex comedy about your parents. I don't recommend it for most people. It will mess you up.
Yeah, so. It is very Freudian.
Oh, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, so how important is it when you're, I guess, when you first got this commission, the Crossroads Commission, right, to come down to Orange County and kind of research the Vietnamese community, did you think, I'm going to write a play for Vietnamese Americans? Because we never get put on stage.
I actually didn't think that at all. Like, when they were very open. They're like, you're going to come down, you're just going to meet people of the Orange County community in general, and you can write anything you wanted. And because, you know, like, the stuff that I've written previously tends to have comic book superheroes and stuff like that, I actually thought I was going to write about geek culture, about Comic-Con, and things like that. And like, so I met a whole bunch of video gamers and a guy who had like a very expensive comic book collection. And then at the very end of the trip, we went to UCI Irvine. Yeah, sorry, I'm not from here.
Yep, he's from Arkansas, right?
I am from Arkansas.
Yeah. Wait, how is that?
Well, you saw the play.
They wanted to move to California with the rest of the Vietnamese.
No, they didn't. Like, my parents, basically, the town where my dad and my mom kind of, like, you know, at that last scene, you know, no spoilers, but when, you know, where they met up, they decided that, you know, they had already lost their home, and they're like, you know, like, we're going to build a new life. Let's build it. You know, like, we don't need to follow everyone else to build something. Let's build it on our own. And so they decided to stay in that small town and build a life that I grew up knowing. But basically I went to UC Irvine. And they have the South Asian American collection there, where it was there, where they had like all these files, pictures of all the refugee camps from 75 when people were just coming over. I saw the one, there was a file for Fort Chaffee where my parents had met. And so I got really obsessed with just trying to see if there were any of those pictures. And I realized during that whole week that was the most important moment. And that's what made me decide to write about my parents.
I mean, how long have you been ruminating on this idea? Just because...
I think
backstory.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to write something about their family, right? Like, I think there's like, like, you know, we all, like, every single person on the planet has an interesting family story to tell. Like, you know, and I just happen to be a playwright and able to have a way to tell those stories. And so I'm just taking that opportunity finally to do so. But I knew that I needed distance. I needed time to figure out how to tell it and tell it in my voice, not telling a general, generic Vietnamese story that I felt was scary. I didn't feel like I had the ability to do it before. And I feel like it took like 10 years of being, you know, a vampire cowboys artist to get to a point where I can tell like my parents' story in that way. Yeah. That was very much me. Yeah. Not trying to pretend to be someone else. Because I used to try to pretend to be David Henry Wong, and that did not work out well.
I feel like every Asian American playwright.
Yeah, you read something by him, and you're like, and I love him, and he's super important. But, you know, like, I knew, you know, I couldn't be David Henry Wong or Bruce Lee, and so I was like, I have to figure out my own version of being a fight director and being a playwright. And so, you know, I think that's why my voice sounds the way it does. So.
And also kind of makes it, I want to say palatable, but it makes it, like, you look, like, just having that lingo, it's kind of like what happened when I saw Hamilton for the first time.
Right.
It's like seeing this topic that you thought you knew pretty well because it's so ingrained in the popular culture, and then seeing it through this very specific lens of
hip-hop.
Hip-hop and contemporary language, and these people who are actually, were living people who are sexy and fucked around, and...
Yeah.
and
we
kind
can
of
cuss on this podcast.
Yes, we can cuss on this podcast.
I've been like trying to say very clean. So because
I know, and I expected, you know, more colorful language from you.
Well, I don't really fucking know, like, what I can say. You know, sometimes I show up and like people stop their pods, like, don't say that. I'm like, oh, sorry, I didn't know children listen to this. So.
No, children do not listen to this. It's mostly theater geeks and the people who love them.
Well, fuck.
Thank you. Well, it's like the first 5 minutes of your play was fuck, and then I thought, oh man, can I take my dad to this?
Yeah. No, I was in that room too, and I've heard a lot of, you know, folks that were like, oh my, and then, but luckily, you know, halfway through first act one, they all kind of calmed down. I was like, oh well, that's just the way it's going to sound. I was like, yeah. You know, I feel like it's inauthentic if I didn't write the way I write. You know, like, this is the way it sounds in my head. This is the way it's going to be. It's like if you show up to a Gary's play and everyone suddenly stop cussing, you're like, that doesn't feel like New York at all. And so I'm just trying to be true to the characters and the voices, you know.
Yeah. But it kind of revitalizes that topic, too.
Yeah. Well, it's the 40th anniversary of, you know, the fall of Saigon. So.
Yeah. do you ever feel like, you know, when that comes around, like it feels very heavy in an odd way, even though you didn't really experience it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, anytime...
It's like a collective memory of, oh, shoot, this is when everything changed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, if anything, it was just growing up, you know, in the 80s where, like, every single movie was based on, you know, some, you know, Vietnamese, you know, or Vietnam vet, whether it be Rambo or Platoon or Full Metal Jacket. Like, you just felt like it was so much in our... you know, our conscience, our social conscience. And then, you know, now we're 40 years removed and there's been other wars in between, obviously, that you know, like, Vietnam still pops up because, you know, as it says in the play, like, you always hear it's like, oh, if they're not careful, it'll be another Vietnam. It's still seen as a complete negative. And as my dad had said to me, it's like, it hurts them. Like, when people look at, because he knows that they're talking about the war, but just to say the sentence, you know, it'll be another Vietnam in a negative context. It's like, I don't want people to think of the country that I fought hard. We lost, absolutely. But I fought hard to try to keep as my home. Like, I don't want people to think of it in a negative way. And now I'm like, well, people are going to take vacations there. So,
Yep. Resorts. There are fancy luxury.
Fancy resorts there, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's also this story that you don't really see, because whenever people think of Vietnam, it's Americans versus the Viet Cong, and
right.
They kind of forget, oh, there was actually...
The South Vietnamese were there too.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah.
It's like, we exist, but we're not really represented in it.
No, it's always seen as like, oh, there's one who's escaped.
Yeah.
You know, and they were taken care of, and, you know, it's like, no, there were families that, and men who fought really hard, you know, and so, and that's, it's kind of the context that I want people to see, that there's a different part of this war, that, you know, now we're starting to, you know, because there's been a war in between, that the focus has fallen off from Vietnam, but, you know, it's my story, it's my family's story, it's your story, you know, and so it's like, oh, I think it's still important for people to know, to just know that part of history. I also just wanted to tell an immigration story where it wasn't people going, I can't wait to get to America. Because it was basically like, I can't believe we're here. Or in my dad's case, he didn't want to be here. My grandma didn't want to be here. They wanted to be back in Vietnam, but they lost their country. And so I wanted to give that kind of immigrant story where it's not about folks who fought hard to be here. It was very much like they were fighting to keep their country. And then they had to find a way to adapt in this new situation. Because that was their story. It wasn't like, you know, I wasn't trying to find a different angle. I just grew up knowing that they longed, and, you know, for, you know, their home country. You know,
when you did the reading at the was it the Vietnamese Vala?
Vala, yeah, the Vietnamese. Oh, I can't remember what it stands for because I'm not from Orange County. But it was a Vietnamese community, you know, group that, you know, specifically works with the young and youthful people with, like, spoken word and hip-hop and stuff like that. But it was amazing. Like, it was basically what we just had, except for the whole room was all Vietnamese people, or, you know, from different ages, from, like, you know, 16 all the way up. But, you know, and one guy, after we did that reading, actually was like, I know your dad. Like, this older gentleman. I was like, wait, what do you mean? You know, he's like, I trained at where he trained at. Like, I was the class right after him. And so I immediately called my dad. I was like, hey, do you know this guy? He's on, like, my dad was the 225th squadron. He was, like, the 227th. And he's like, oh, yeah. Like, they actually knew each other. I was like, oh, that's right. It wasn't like millions of people like immigrated from Vietnam. It was thousands. And of course there would be, you know, and they all found themselves at Wake Island before they made it to the refugee camps here. And so there was a good chance that that generation would kind of have some, you know, cross-hatching, you know? And so, yeah, so it was an amazing thing because there were people who knew my parents. And it was like, oh, I didn't realize that that would be part of the experience of telling the story. And it was very clear because they, when they heard the story, they're like, I know who that guy is. You know, I know where he was at. Like, they could really, so that's when I felt like I was really good with my facts because the facts by themselves let them know who I was talking about. And so we made some new connections from people in the community with my family. So that was really great. And it was just great to have like a whole bunch of non-theater people, you know, like experience it. If anything, that made today's reading so intimidating because it basically had the same kind of this really high energy, big reaction. Just, you know, and I was like, oh, I wonder how now if my industry peers would feel the same way. Like, because it's intimidating. Because one was just like, oh, you guys don't watch theater, so maybe you don't have an expectation. So it's all really cool, and to have that kind of same reaction today was just like, it felt really warming to go, oh, okay, it's not just for theater people. It's not just for not theater people. Both sides seem to really take to it the same way.
Yeah, well, it was a very diverse crowd today, too.
Yeah, a lot of the community came out for it. Like, they hadn't even come for the other PPF things. They had come because they were part of the Vietnamese community. They're like, oh, you're going to do this, then we're coming out to see it. And I was like, oh. So it was really, really great to have them all out there to experience it.
Were you kind of surprised, like, how well they took to the atypical structure?
Yeah.
Because it's, like, it's very, very contemporary.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not chronological. It bounces around in time. It's as influenced by Tarantino as it is influenced by, you know, David Henry Wong, as it's influenced by, you know, Jay-Z. So, you know, and all those influences help make it. And, of course, my family store and Vampire Cowboys, but it's just been, like, a... You know, you always get scared because, you know, like, I'm just like, I don't know how people will take to my voice. I doubled down on trying to be a singular artist. I wasn't going to try to write like anybody else basic structure, Aristotelian structure. And I'm just like, hopefully, you know, people will take to it. And it seems so far like they do. You know, so.
Yeah. I mean, how important is it for this kind of institutional support when it comes to, like, putting these underrepresented stories on stage?
Well, I think it's usually important. I think it's so, I mean, like, I think it's so crucial that to have, you know, especially when it comes to those underrepresented communities, to see, like, high-quality theater, you know, to see it at, you know, with full, you know, professional production values. So that, you know, like, yeah, I could write a thing in a community theater and it's going to still be important. But I think if I'm trying to influence and give, you know, inspiration to a younger generation or to anyone in an underrepresented community about what you could do, I think it's important that a bigger institution is connected to it. So they can see that, you know, what it can be, not just what it could be, but what can be. And so I think it was instrumental that, you know, a large theater like South Coast Rep, you know, kind of gave me the opportunity to do that for the Vietnamese community here. But, you know, not just the community here, but like for myself, my family, for anyone that looks like me, basically, or anyone who feels underrepresented, you know?
Yeah. Kind of, it's like a legitimacy in a way.
Absolutely. Legitimacy is very important, I think, for especially when you're trying to tell something that you feel that's important. You want the loudest, you know, microphone in the room, you know. You don't want to be like, oh, here it is, we're going to be in the corner. And like, you know, and I totally write those plays too. And I love writing those plays for my niche, you know, fans, like that love Vampire Cowboys. I love, like, they built me, you know. And I love writing for the geeks of New York, without a doubt. But this was a story that... I felt like needed to be, you know, had to be told to a bigger audience than just, you know, the Comic-Con kids in New York City, you know?
Which, nothing against the Comic-Con kids
in New York City. I love the Comic-Con kids in New York City.
Bless Bless those geeks.
Yeah. Hey, I wouldn't have a career without them. You know, yeah. They were giving me money to see shows before anyone gave me a grant. You know what I'm saying? So they definitely are my backbone.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Six Rounds of Vengeance? That's the newest Vampire Cowboy show going on
right
now.
Six Rounds of Vengeance is happening right now. I unfortunately missed opening night tonight. And so it's a sequel to Soul Samurai, and it's basically set in the post-apocalypse, and it's basically our version of creating a African-American hero set in the West, kind of like Django, but specifically a LGBT or a gay hero. So there's because like so much of Vampire Cowboys, we for years said it was our secret mission because we didn't put it on our website. We didn't tell the world yet because we wanted people to come to our shows because it was about superheroes, it was action adventures, about hip hop or puppetry or whatever we were going to do, which we do all that stuff in every single one of our shows. And we wanted people to be interested in it. Our secret mission was always all our lead characters, all our heroes would be either a person of color, LGBT, or definitely female. And so it's like, oh, because our thing was, if you want to see white guys in tights, they're everywhere. Like, you just go to the movie theaters and there's a million white guys in tights. And here was our chance to create a hero for, people who don't get to see themselves that way. And so we've kind of hit the gambit. We've done like a hero and, we've had like lesbian heroes, we've had Asian heroes, Latino heroes, black heroes. And here was a chance to, at some point it dawned on us that we had, for almost 8 years, we hadn't touched on a gay male superhero in almost like 8 years since Men of Steel. And so it was our chance to kind of create that. And, I've grown as a writer too, and to put that out there. And so it's a spaghetti Western action adventure, killing monsters and yetis and vampires. But the lead character is a guy who's in love with a guy and is trying to save the world and get revenge for his death. And then, of course, it turns around as you discover that, that guy's actually still alive. He's actually
Oh my god, you're spoiling it for me!
I'm not spoiling it. He's not actually alive. I take it back. But it's it's a great adventure. It has a lot of cool theatrics, and so it's a really fun way to explore that. And of course, him being gay is actually not the issue at all. Like, we never actually ever talk about that. It's just, he happens to be in love with a dude, and so that's always been a huge mission. But at this point, after about 12 years of doing Vampire Cowboy shows, I think the secret mission of Vampire Cowboys is not so secret anymore. Considering people here, they're like, "We would love it. We have people of color. You should write for us." It's like, "Oh, so you kind of know what I do." So that's always been what makes us. It's that mission and the way we do, our theatrics has kind of distinguished us as a quote unquote geek theater, besides being, quote unquote the innovators of the thing, the pioneers of it. We also feel like beyond that, because we actually have never called ourselves geek theater.
Yeah, who coined that term for you guys?
I think.
Besides us.
Yeah. Well, actually, the first time I ever heard it was our producer, Abby, was writing a grant for us. It's like you start a theater company and you need to have a mission, and our first mission was like something super generic, like, we write innovative shows for a hungry audience. He's like, that's every company, that's what they all want to do. Tell us what you want to do. And so we were telling him, Robert Ross Barker, the other artistic director, myself, was telling Abby all the stuff we wanted to do, and she's like, oh, so you guys are doing geek theater. And so she kind of made it up and put it, and she wrote it specifically to be in a grant proposal. And so, and it wasn't even, she just needed some kind of heading over it. It's like, she's like, it was not physical theater, it's not comedy, it's not vaudeville. It's like, because we do puppetry, we do multimedia, but she knew that we weren't any of those things. She didn't know how to categorize it, and so she kind of created a category. And so that was the first time I ever heard it. And then, of course, I think the Village Voice had said it. I know that they didn't talk to each other. I saw it at the Times. I know no, like, so I think it just started to grow from, people had to find a way to categorize us. And then TCG called us that, and American Theater Magazine, and, I think Raven Snook called us that, or Alexis Lasky called us that. It's like, we started to cry. And then, then you have, Mac Rogers and Crystal Skillmans and all this other, Adam Simkowitz starting to write those things. And so they started creating a banner, kind of a genre. But we ourselves, Robert and I, when we create shows, we've never actually called ourselves geek theater. We always call ourselves Vampire Cowboys. Because we're always like, I don't necessarily, I don't know what geek theater is, honestly. I just know that that's what we're doing. We were just actually, we always said we were just doing Vampire Cowboy shows, which had all these things, because we knew that there's a secret mission that meant so much to us on top of the superhero stuff. And so, that's how it kind of grew out of that organically. You know, there was never a conscious, like, we want to create a theater movement. It's like, no, we just want to, we just want to tell fun shows that no one else wants to produce. You know, because that's where we kind of, it was like, no one wants to produce my vampire show, but I can. So that's how it kind of came out.
You created a theater genre. That's what you did.
Yeah, yeah. I but
do you feel like pioneers, or do you feel like, oh man, I am an important person?
Absolutely not. Because
my those are my books about me someday.
My bank account does not make me feel like a pioneer at all. Or maybe it does, because pioneers like crossed places and died, so you know, by, from starvation and you know disease. And so maybe I do feel like a pioneer. Absolutely. So
your life is like Oregon Trail.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like, I kind of would like to be a settler instead of a pioneer. You know, like, oh, someone else pioneered this trail and I want to like cash in on it. You know, and, you know, so yeah, I guess I do, but not like pat on myself on the back, just in the sense that I'm aware that there's our work at Vampire Cowboys is what it is, because, you know, it's hard to put us in a category. It's hard to go, oh, I can imagine a bigger institution producing. And though they are now, people are starting to get curious and wanting, you know, me to write for them. When the impetus was, we kind of knew that, like, we didn't feel like anyone would want to. And so it kind of forced us, you know, it's like a, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Like, that's what it came down to. Like, we didn't know how to tell these stories in any other way. And so that's how we kind of became what we were.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't want to make a film about it because it's not...
No, we're theater geeks.
It's not conducive to film,
yeah, we're theater geeks. I love theater. I love the immediacy of theater. I love being in the room with people. I love that energy that's fed to the, you know, to the actors that gets fed back to the audience. Look, we just finished, our preview period for Six Rounds, and Robert called me, and we were, like, talking about cuts from the preview. And, like, you know, another dear friend of ours who's a director was in the room, and she was very much like, I feel weird about you guys making those cuts, because I like that play. And he's like, see, Vampire Cowboys actually isn't in the business of writing plays. We're in the business of creating awesome show. And so, and it is.
That's a mission statement.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a different thing. Like, we, you know, it's like, I, you know, Vic Gone, I wanted to write a really great play. Vampire Cowboys, I'm kind of creating a circus, you know? And so, so we were cutting, I cut 20 pages out of the play, to make sure that we were, that circus feeling, you know, ultimately we want people cheering at the end of the show, not just like clapping. And at the end of our first preview, people were clapping very loudly, but there was no cheers. And so I did the 20 page cut, and then last night we opened and we got the reaction we were hoping for. And so I knew that was the right thing, but some of my most, you know, well-written scenes about loss weren't in there, which was sad, you know, because I always was, you know, but you got to kill your babies, you know, so though I love those scenes, then, you know, I buried them, so.
You can't put them in your next plays about,
Say that, it's like, you can save them, but no one ever actually pulls out that drawer, like, you put them, it's like, oh, I'll save it for later, no one ever goes in the for later pile, so.
I remember, like, the first Vampire Cowboy show I saw from you when I first moved to New York was She Kills Monsters. And
Yeah.
And it was one of those times where you don't see very many shows about women that passes the Bechdel test, that's about family and sisterhood and loss, but it was in this package of she's going to go play Dungeons and Dragons and fight a dragon at the end.
Yeah. Well, it's always been important to me when I'm going to put a female character on stage, for them to be really strong, and not just strong because they know kung fu.
Yeah.
Like, they're strong because they're complex and they, you know, they have a full life. Because I'm just like anyone who's, you know, in our business, I guess, who gets that distaste when you see the quote unquote strong female character in a, like, a cartoon or a movie where they're like, the only thing that makes her strong is the fact that she is physically strong.
Yeah, and she plays a girlfriend. That's all she does.
Yeah, if she's a girlfriend or she can karate kick someone. I want to make sure that, no, it's because they have real motivations that are complex. That it is definitely from the fact that I'm a person of color, you know, because I'm underrepresented. I know what it feels like to be underrepresented. So when I go in to write for someone who's underrepresented, in, you know, when it comes to this stuff, that I want them to have as much color, as much complexity as, you know, what they would see with a quote unquote white male character.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing what you do.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for talking to me.
Oh my God.
Spending time with me and being my friend.
And we're back, and we'll do some quick recommendations round, a speed round. I saw Red Bull Theater's Tis Pity She's a Whore this past
Not
Saturday.
Tis A Pity, yeah, like you wrote on your Facebook?
It's apparently idiomatic in Elizabethan and Jacobean English to say Tis Pity. There's a speech in Hamlet where he says Tis True, Tis Pity if True, or something like that. So, okay. So it's not Tis a Pity She's a Whore. And I would say it really is amazing that play was written, and written when it was. It's emphasis on it's just single-minded emphasis on incest as its central plot element, and its attitude toward authority and religion. I need to read more about it. Red Bull's production emphasizes the modern sensibility of it, but it's just. It almost is hard to believe it was written when it was. I've never seen Red Bull's work that's very strong and very contemporary sensibility. So I would recommend Tis Pity She's a Whore. And if you're in town, I think it's only running for another week at, the Duke Theater, Red Bull Theater's Tis Pity She's a Whore. And it's by John Ford, who's not the film director, but go on. What you got?
Oh, God. Can I recommend Hand of God? Is that?
Yes,
should we talk about that again?
We recommend, talked about recommend it. Hand of God. I second your recommendation.
Okay, fine. Because I saw two shows last week, and I'm going to recommend one of them. Okay. I finally saw Hand of God. I know. I'm kind of late to this, to the Tyrone Love Show.
The Tyrone Love Show?
I don't know if I would call it love. The demon-possessed puppet.
I don't know. Tyrone that hates. Was... I don't know about that, just because that was a really long puppet sex scene. It's like the longest I've ever seen on Broadway. But
yeah. It's funny. It was Sarah Stiles did, and she was in Avenue Q, so she's experienced.
Yeah, she's a puppet sex expert. It's in her special skills on her resume.
Yeah, no, that I don't think you can really top that puppet sex scene. That was probably the longest and most graphic you ever want to go.
And not only just because there's puppet sex, but because their arms are doing one thing, having sex,
yeah,
and then their faces and the other parts of their bodies were doing something completely different.
Right.
When she says arms, she means the puppets on the children's hands who are having sex while the children are having a separate conversation.
Exactly. And they're not actually played
by
children.
We say children, yeah. I mean,
they're not played by children, teens. But they're supposed to be
preteens. Hand of God at the Booth Theater by Rob Askins. And then that next to Fun Home is the most subversive thing I've seen on Broadway in a very long time. And it's not even so much the fact that, you know, there's puppet sex and lots of, you know, fucks to be had, which you know, which you find that in Avenue Q, you find that in Book of Mormon, but it's also because it's this dinky little play that started off at a tiny little black box theater, and now suddenly it's given like the multi-million dollar treatment,
right,
from this playwright no one's ever heard of up until this point. And he's talking about like puberty and art and the modern struggle with religion. And how religion is basically an answer to the chaos in our lives, and we just made it up because we couldn't take owning our sin. And so, like that is some revolutionary way to think about religion, especially when you place it in a modern Broadway context.
Huh, yeah.
Well, producer Kevin McCollum is very big on finding the next It off Broadway thing. Kevin McCollum. He did Avenue Q. I mean, did he do In the Heights? He worked on In the Heights.
I thought it was with the other guy.
It was Jeffrey Seller was the lead producer, but I think Kevin worked on it.
He was on Rent, as far as I know.
And he was Kevin on Rent, too. I mean, he's got a good track record, so people seem to like Hand of God.
It's very likable. Do you like it?
I think it is a very, very well-made play, and I really enjoy the performances, and I think you could not construct a better play. I could only watch it once. Too gory.
Oh, really? I can watch it multiple times. The goriness was the best part.
I was so bracing myself because I don't have a big stomach for gore.
I have zero stomach for gore.
It just felt kind of, I mean, the gore, no spoilers here, but the gore felt more sort of silly, gross out gore. It wasn't like, oh my God, I cannot stand to watch. It's like, oh, yikes. You know, it didn't really.
Oh, I covered my eyes for the last 15 minutes. I think it's a very well-made play. It's a good play.
Yeah, I felt like the second act was not as good as the first, but I found it. You know, first of all, it's a great time, and also it's really substantial.
Well, I've seen it twice at this point.
Feeling behind it. And that was too much?
It's too much. I mean, I think it's a great play. I just don't like all the blood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, it reminded me a little bit of The Descent of Inishmore, and I could not stomach that play. And that was on Broadway, too. And that one has a similar kind of like reveal of the second act. You remember, you know, like there's dismembered bodies and blood everywhere. This reveal of what happens to the basement is like similar. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm looking at that. But you know,
it's like Hello Kitty with her eyes cut out.
Yeah,
and like
don't spoil
dolls,
it.
Like,
spoiler. It's a spoiler.
The people listening to this won't know to look for it. There's no photos of it.
What's the
spoiler? Is what the reveal in the second act.
What's the one that says Jesus love or something like?
Well, now we're just giving it away.
Yeah, anyway, there was a funny one about God listens to Slayer. Or no, it was Jesus listens to Slayer. Someone wrote it. That's pretty funny. All right. Anyway, Susie, you have a recommendation?
Sure. I have been on a theater fast this week, and by that I mean I have been seeing nothing. But I did see one thing that I really liked, and I'll recommend it. I went and saw the cabaret show Molly Pope Likes Your Status at the Duplex. Molly Pope is one of my favorite performers. She's kind of a cabaret artist. She's been called like a young Bette Midler type. She's got a very unique voice. She kind of does like a old school belt on like modern songs. One of the songs in her show is Royals by Lord. She's very downtown-y, but she's, you know, very funny. Really, her medium is cabaret, but she's been in, she was in Found at the Atlantic. She just did a show at La Mama called Horseplay. She's been around for a long time. I don't know why she hasn't had more success. She should. But yeah, she's a little cabaret show at the Duplex, and I just think she's wonderful, and I had a really good time at it. And if you're not in New York to catch that, I think it's a monthly show, first Friday of every month at the Duplex. There is a plethora of videos of her on YouTube performing all sorts of fun cabaret things, so I recommend you go down a Molly Pope YouTube spiral.
I've heard a lot about her.
Ooh, shoot.
Yes?
There's something else I can recommend that's not a show. I mean, that's not
theater.
We just had a big
conversation about Hand to God.
I know, but I feel like we already had that conversation.
Yeah, what is it?
Okay, I recently discovered RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah.
And which is basically a parody of Project Runway,
right,
and America's Next Top Model, which is, you know, 14 drag queens compete.
Right.
For
Did you see Jinx Monsoon? Is that who you're trying to tell me about? No.
Huh? Jinx Monsoon won the season 5 of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Right. She's speaking of major cabaret artists, but go on.
Yeah.
And they do acting challenges.
Oh my God!
Where they
amazing.
Have to, where they're given scripts and they have to prep. They have like maybe 24 to 48 hours to prep. And mm-hmm. there was one episode this season where the episode was called Shakes Queer, and they did queer adaptations of Shakespeare's plays, like a version of Macbeth set in a high school cheerleading tryout, and they called it McBitch.
Okay. So how much do they do it? They just do a little snippet of it?
No, they gave you like a nice 5-minute skit.
That sounds funny.
So if you've never seen RuPaul's Drag Race, you can watch it on logotv.com. They have the full episodes on there, and there's some really talented women on that show. Men, women, people, individuals.
Know. Yes. That reminds me, I have a recommendation that I want to trump the other one, really, which is to go to a YouTube video of Marie Osmond from the show Ripley's Believe It or Not. This is from like the 70s or 80s, in which she recites a sound poem by Hugo Ball, a major Dada artist.
Oh, gosh. Ooh.
And she is really worth seeing. It will warp your mind. I think on that note, let's close this issue.
We're real organized this
edition
this week,
of Opscript. On a very Dada note. Enjoy.